Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Well, hello for everybody on the 15th of February. I'm glad everybody's on the call. So we'll just get started here. Let's see, the first question. Hi, Rick. Thank you for your insight in the question I posted last week. I hope all is well with you. This past week, a new issue was born. My wife asked the question, if some of the things I wanted to do during intimacy were as a result of the years of pornography that I viewed. She questions my behaviors in bed. I have been been pornography sober for 2 months. As she asked if her involvement sexually would hinder my recovery in stopping the view of pornography. I feel as if any request I make during intimacy outside the standard is viewed as wrong. I respect my wife. She does not feel comfortable participating in certain sexual acts. I will not push it. However, I feel as if my opinions are immediately blunted. Even discussing the issue at hand makes her uncomfortable and in turn pushes me to avoid opening up to her and revealing intimate thoughts. From my point of view, there are things that intimately I had avoided mentioning to her after our affairs. I feel we had been able to open up. However, there are still sexual intimate issues I can clearly see that bother her. She wanted to know if these were some sort of guide that God provided, or maybe instructions the Bible mentioning the appropriate sexual conduct of a married couple, the appropriate type of conduct that a married couple should engage in. Please advise. Thank you. Okay. I want to start by setting just a foundation. This is a really difficult topic. In fact, there's two sexually based questions, I think, today, and so I'm glad we're going to be able to talk about these. And it's because I do think it's a really big issue, and it's a big issue for both the unfaithful as well as for the hurt spouse. And I know that part of the problem, as we begin to come back together after infidelity, there are a lot of questions about, well, just intrusive thoughts where things begin to come into the bedroom and what's normal, what's not normal. I think that there's probably a lot more normal than most people give credit to, and yet some things, you know, at a certain level, depending on how we view sexuality, for instance, if you've got kind of a negative view about sex to begin with because of maybe religious inhibitions and how you were raised and ultimately sex is bad except inside of marriage, I mean, the whole concept that sex is bad gives us kind of a, except inside of marriage, still gives us a negative connotation at one level about sex. Not that I'm saying we should be having sex outside of marriage. That's not the point. But so much negativity is associated to this topic. It's interesting, even if you knock on a door when a woman's changing, I mean, or a guy's changing, typically the question you would ask is, you know, are you decent? And, I mean, what an absolutely absurd question. I mean, bottom line is, of course. I mean, behold, it's very good. I mean, the problem isn't our sexuality. The problem is how we have ultimately viewed our sexuality. So in addressing this question, I think there has to be a much higher view of what the whole thing is about to begin with. I mean, what's the problem? Why are we doing it? So I think it's a little difficult to answer this maybe in just like 5 or 10 minutes. But ultimately, I believe that, you know, our sexuality and the expression of who we are as man and woman is one of the primary ways that those of us from a faith perspective truly image God. And that ultimately our sexuality was supposed to be, I believe, one of the most, primary tools that was available to us to reveal something of the love of God, to experience something about God, to understand something of God, that our sexuality ultimately was supposed to be this vehicle that literally revealed something in the very throne room of heaven. To me, if you want to know what's most important, maybe in God's economy of things, is you just need to look at what I think the devil has worked the hardest at, you know, defaming or, you know, profaning. And I think that's sexuality. I mean, and I think he's attacked sexuality simply because it interferes with our ability to understand God. Your wife's question, you know, has your pornography in some way influenced how you see things? I think that your pornography or use pornography has probably severely influenced how both of you see things. In fact, I think pornography in the world is always maybe changing and shifting how we see things. But the bigger issue, I think, isn't, you know, kind of what we do sexually. It's how we understand why we're being sexual. If the actual pieces of what happens in that marriage bed maybe aren't even the most important. For instance, as I look at it, the problem with pornography isn't the fact that it shows too much of a person. The problem with pornography is that it doesn't show nearly enough, because it shows another human being being void of the image of God, void of, you know, the glory of God. So you look at the Sistine Chapel and you look at Penthouse, Playboy. I mean, ultimately, both of those have nudes. But the intent of the artist, I mean, the problem with pornography is the intent of the artist. The intent of Michelangelo, I believe, was literally to reveal something of the glory of God. It was to, you know, it was to image God in many ways and to show the love of God. The problem with pornography, it shows too little. It's actually trying to draw us to something that is other than God. It's in Romans chapter 1 would actually say we worship and serve created things. I mean, but ultimately it's void of love. That ultimately lust then would be nothing more than sexual desire void of the love of God. It is not about the other person. My sexuality was ultimately a vehicle through which I was supposed to be able to love my mate and for my mate to be able to love me. It's a place where we imaged oneness. But when it begins to be a place, as you talk about here in your little post, where, you know, is this about something negative? Is it about something positive? You know, I wish you could get back to the place of right now. It's the place, I mean, and it needs to be, the place where we begin to image love. In the Married for Life series, we actually begin to address some of the topics about sexuality, which I think are incredibly important. Because I want, this should actually be the place that we own. I mean, not the place that's been destroyed. We should be the people that are the least inhibited and the most understanding. And you know, I mean, I would love for you, when you begin to, you know, see your wife, not to think about porn or the acts or whatever, but to ultimately begin to experience something of love, a compassion and a love for her, not just kind of a need for her to love you and vice versa, that when she sees you, I hope that she can experience you love, your love for her, but also in return begin to look at you and figure out how in the world does she begin to enjoy you? How do our souls ultimately connect? That the touch that happens in that marital embrace in our marriage bed, you know, that is literally a dynamic expression of the feelings being generated in the moment as the two of us ultimately come together. It's the place where we're able to be naked and not ashamed, and it ought to be a completely safe place. Now, one of the things I suggest that couples do in order to maybe stay connected as they work through these things is make lots of eye contact. In other words, I suggest when couples are making love, especially after they're dealing with infidelity, is they try to maintain eye contact during intercourse. And the reason being, I think that in the long run, that you know the other person is present with you, that the eyes are the window to the soul, and as long as you can see their eyes, y'all can both be present in the moment. And maybe the two of you should have a discussion of, you know, what's our ultimate goal? here. I don't think the ultimate goal of our lovemaking needs to be to avoid something. I think the ultimate goal of our lovemaking needs to be able to express love, to be able to connect, to be able to experience joining with another person, you know, maybe the one place where I can be fully me. Accept it, okay, it is good enough, just the way I am, even though I may not be perfect. Now, for your wife, she wants to know what type of maybe influence the pornography has had and all of that. And I think that the discussion would probably be need to be a two-way conversation about, you know, how has it impacted the way she sees it, even if she hasn't seen stuff. I mean, I find that typically for the hurt spouse, the whole aspect of pornography or affairs, being with another person, also have a profound impact of how they begin to view sex and how they begin to view themselves. And so an honest discussion about how it's impacted your views and your understanding. I tell couples all the time from the very beginning, the one thing you don't want to do is you don't want to make orgasms, for instance, the focus. I mean, the whole focus is creating a moment where the two of us are together. I mean, to me, lovemaking with Stephanie is far more about a renewal of vows. It's the place where there's almost like a remembrance of who we are and an expression where we come together, and it's a free, total, faithful, fruitful love. I mean, that to me is a love of God. I come freely every time I'm with her, as does she, and I come totally. I try to bring all of who I am in an effort to be with her, as does she with me, and it's faithful and it's fruitful. I mean, ultimately, it's not as much about trying to please the other person as it is my attempt to ultimately try to enjoy the other person. Untwisting all of the lies that I think all of us carry, you and your wife, from pornography, from the world, even from the church, that's going to be something that's going to take the two of you a long time. Some things you might want to read, Lehman's book, Sheet Music, is a really good book. I really like anything by Pinner and Pinner, Joyce and Clifford Pinner. Frequently when couples are having trouble, I recommend Restoring the Pleasure. I mean, when you sit there and think, the last thing, she wanted to know if there's some sort of guide that God provided or maybe instructions in the Bible mentioning appropriate sexual conduct. Not that I know of. I mean, if you read the Song of Solomon, you'll find that to be somewhat racy and very interesting. I certainly wouldn't say in that process that you know, that there's just one particular way to go about doing all this thing. But I would, those books, Sheet Music, The Gift of Sex is another one I think that's very good. If the two of you were to read one of those books out loud together, you would find that would be an amazing gift. It would probably give the two of you both a lot to talk about. So let me go to the next question because it's still on the same thing. During our phone call on Thursday, there was a question about intimacy and sexual desires at this stage of recovery. In stage of recovery for this group, they just came out of EMS a month ago. Can you post something to the group on regards to this? I told them I would pass it on. I had mentioned that I thought there would be more info related to sexuality at the end of MLF, but I need directions. But they need directions now as to how, what, when, and where of having sex. And I think one of the things that was raised in this question that's not posted here was a question about arousal templates. And I think that it was a little bit, maybe a little bit of confusion. So let me start with arousal templates. The way that we function as couples sexually is absolutely amazing. I mean, probably one of the things that makes me believe in a creator more than anything else is the incredible aspects of our sexuality and how we come together and I think ultimately what it represents. One of the interesting things, though, about how we come together as husbands and wives or as men, how we develop sexually is there's an aspect of us that's called an arousal template. And for whatever reason, I believe the arousal template works by imprinting. But in other words, things that we are exposed to potentially can be imprinted in that arousal template, and we actually can experience some sort of sexual arousal as a result of being exposed to those things. For instance, I've treated guys who are aroused by balloons, or guys who are aroused by dogs and cats and girls and boys and women and, you know, dead people. And there's very, very, I mean, it's an amazing, absolutely amazing number of things that ultimately can be imprinted in that arousal template. And so, you know, there's nothing good or bad about what's in the arousal template. I think a lot of people feel shame because they want to know why in their arousal template maybe spanking is something that they find arousing, and because they find spanking arousing, then somehow there must be something wrong with them. Or some people, I've had a lot of women who've been deeply disturbed because they have rape fantasies, and they don't know why the concept of rape would somehow be erotic to them, and so they experience a great deal of shame, thinking there must be something wrong with them because that's kind of in that erotic or that arousal template. Let me say that typically most of us have very little to do with what's in the arousal template. I mean, one of the problems with pornography, I think, in the long run is it certainly has the ability to cause things to be imprinted and create a template of arousal around other types of things, and I think that may present a problem. But what's in the arousal template per se isn't necessarily a problem. So when you ask the question, you know, about arousal templates earlier, there's any number of things that anybody, as a husband or wife, may ultimately find arousing or erotic. And in eroticism, again, like the arousal template, there are a number of things that we may find erotic, not just arousing. Why that is, you know, I think that you don't get to choose that stuff. That stuff typically tends to choose you. Let's see. So, down to the, because of that, when we come together as a husband and wife, and I think a lot of times because of the negative views and kind of our understanding of what sex is about and maybe what has been taught on this topic, you know, if you look at pornography, you may be exposed to a lot of things that, you know, are maybe disinhibited to things that ultimately may have been inhibitions to you. You may find some things erotic or arousing that you never would have thought of. And some of them may not even be imprinted. They may have already been there. And so you've got a husband and a wife that may have very different aspects of what is erotic. What makes it complicated now is, especially after infidelity, is the question the first person asked, which is, with those, when we begin to talk about what we find erotic, then that can serve as a reminder or a trigger about previous behavior. And so just the trying to express ourselves in some way sexually with our mate can trigger fear and serve as, again, the reminder to the infidelity, which then causes an emotional flood, and probably intrusive thoughts in the bedroom during the marital embrace are about the most embarrassing or the most, not embarrassing, but one of the most difficult things. I mean, it really can ruin a very good moment, and it just takes one flash of a picture of your mate with someone else, or that doubt and wondering if it's really, are they really there with you, or is it really a fantasy, or whatever. And so those are the obstacles that you ultimately have to begin to work beyond. And so I'm educating and I'm kind of explaining the problem at the same time. I kind of touched on the first one, which was they need direction now as to how to be able to be sexual. And like I said, the main thing you want to do is make sure, I think that there's, I would say that the healthy components to all of it, make sure there's always meaningful conversation so that there's an intimate connection, an emotional connection long before you just, quote, do sex, which I think a lot of couples do. I think there needs to be very clear initiation where there is an expression of a desire to be with another person. I think there needs to be meaningful foreplay that, again, is about our expression of love, where as I touch my mate, it's really a dynamic expression of the feelings being generated in me. And ultimately, my goal and Stephanie's goal, we really try to enjoy one another, not to please each other. But my goal is to really enjoy her and to love her. And because when I'm really enjoying her and I'm finding pleasure in her, she feels far more loved than if I'm just trying to please her. If I'm just trying to please her, oftentimes she feels more like an object. If I sense that Stephanie's really trying to enjoy me and just loves being with me and is finding pleasure in me, I experience that as love. And so I think a lot of times we get a little bit backwards, even as on the what we're really trying to do. So I don't want to make the goal about trying to please the other person. I think it's far more about trying to enjoy and love the other person. And at that point, I think pleasure comes. But I think the goal is a little bit different. The first caveat on when is I want to make sure that people are safe. If there is a potential because of exposure to other people where there may be some sort of sexually transmitted disease, the when is after you know that it's safe or that there's a how that you can do it where people are safe. So I want to start off by saying safety is a really big key when it comes, because love would dictate that you try to take care of your mate. I think that the other quinn, though, is I don't know that there is a set time. I've got couples who have been able to come back together relatively quickly, and there is nothing wrong with that. In fact, generally, I think that, as Frank Pittman says, you know, if you the second you can get back to the place where you can begin to be intimate and you can join, and you can kind of practice that renewal of vows where you can be, begin working with that bonding with each other and being in union with each other, I think that is a huge step ultimately toward healing. Obviously, both of you have to be at the place where you're comfortable with that. And there are lots of reasons that we end up being motivated to be sexual. But, you know, in my mind, there isn't, you know, unless it's an issue of safety or, well, an issue of safety, I would say as soon as you're ready. Again, I would try to make it very much about having eyes open and having a heart connection. I think that's going to be really important, and make sure it's about an expression of love. If intrusive thoughts come during lovemaking, I recommend that couples stop. The person having intrusive thoughts says, well, we need to stop just a second while I get my mind focused again. I just went to the wrong place. It's okay to pull out for a minute, literally stop, pause, maybe talk, connect, keep that eye contact, and then try to go again. Just try to stay connected and keep the bed your bed. In the initial stages of coming back together, a lot of couples, and this maybe is the where, but, well, when still, a lot of couples say that oftentimes after they've experienced infidelity, it's probably the most intimate, meaningful, incredible experience they've ever had. And I believe that happens because frequently, if you've gone through some form of infidelity, it's like the first time ever that there's true intimacy. In a very strange way, you know, you're being far more real and and honest with each other than ever before, and that does create a profound experience. And I remember the first time Stephanie ever made love with me afterwards, and it was, I thought, probably the first time I was ever loved unconditionally. Because at that moment, in no way did I feel worthy. At the same time, I was astounded by her willingness to love and her passion for me. And that is a life-changing sort of event when we can come together. And I think my willingness to kind of address my issues and just trying to love and protect her, she saw those things. So I thought that was also important. Again, the where to me in the initial stages, as you begin to reestablish that bond, I think it's probably best to keep it safe, so that in the where, you know, you're not at a place where you're going to be triggering a safe place. That's what I'm saying, because you don't want to be a place where it's going to trigger memories. For instance, if I've got one couple, and in the infidelity, the other person's lover was in the master bedroom. Well, actually, that made that place a rather difficult place to be sexual for them. That was not a good where anymore. So maybe that gives a little bit of direction on that one. And I'm sure we can pose some more questions about sex. We can talk about them next time. Again, Lehman's book, Sheet Music, God Sex is a good one by Bell. Sex God, one of those two. Any of those would be good. And then in the Married for Life course, you'll be getting to that at week 9. Here's another one. If divorce is on the table, let's see. It's been a rough battle since 2008, June, with some times where I thought we were actually going to make it, and bad times that led us to where we are today. I have divorce papers ready to be signed in order to begin the whole process. My husband doesn't want a divorce, neither do I. But I have felt that I have only two choices, divorce or stay in a marriage with a man who continues in a relationship with another woman. He tells me that he is finished with that and wants to work things out with me. I want to believe him, but I have a hard time doing that. We have actually discussed things we would do to work on our marriage, but we keep disagreeing, but we disagree on something. It has been suggested to me, after the latest revelation of him having contact with her, that he move out until he proves that he should be at home with me. I thought about that and told him that I want him to do that, partly because I'm tired of him living here and still being in contact with her, and partly because living in the same house makes it easy for him to not really change and for me not to seek out real change. He doesn't want to move out and says it doesn't make sense to him to move out while trying to work on things. I guess my question is this. If we've come up with some things we would be willing to do in order to work on our relationship, in your opinion, would it be better for him to stay home and us try to do that? Or is it really possible to be apart and still do things to work on our marriage together? He isn't able to tell me why this time is different, why this time won't end up looking like other times. He says it's different because he's willing to do these things we talked about. We were at a similar place this past June where I had some things I wanted him to do if he was going to move home and work on us. Those things didn't last very long before he was right back in a relationship with her. So I'm concerned about trying again, only to find out a couple of months that he's lied again. But I am willing to hold on to my marriage and work at restoring it if he's truly through with her. And if him moving out is more of a hindrance to that than a help, I want to know. I want to put us in a position for the best possibility of success. I know you can't make my decisions or choices for me, but can you give me your opinion or advice? I am really desperate. Okay. So I don't know that there's a best answer or a totally right answer here, I will do what I can do to help with it. If someone says that they're willing to do whatever it's take and that they're serious about it and all of that, my first thought is they're probably serious as a heart attack. I suspect for your husband, the first time when you got married and he told you that he wouldn't ever cheat on you, he was probably serious as a heart attack. I suspect after he got caught and you went through the first thing in 2008 and he said that he never wanted to do it again, that he would never do it again, I'm sure he was serious as a heart attack. The problem is anybody saying they're not going to do it by no means means that they won't do it. It means at that moment that they won't do it because they don't want to do it. But moments change and new moments come. And the only way I know whether somebody can actually have a relationship outside of their marriage or cheat on their mate is if they've done it. And if they've done it, I know for sure they're capable of doing it again because they began not wanting to do it and they did it. And so they're saying they don't want to do it in no way assures that they won't do it. It just means that in that moment, they're in their heart, and I'm sure this is really true, they don't want to do it. And of course, the problem with infidelity, especially if you're dealing with another person, is that, you know, the other person's a wild card. I've never had a bottle of beer when I'm dealing with an alcoholic call up one of my clients and cause him to relapse. So, you know, that's it's a lot dicier than that. The other thing that kind of raises a bit of a red flag for me as I read this one is I don't know what the two of you are doing in the marriage or kind of what the plans are you're trying to do, but if you think that improving the marriage will somehow keep the relationship with the affair partner from continuing, that's very scary to me, simply because, again, it's pragmatically smart for someone to continue working on the marriage as long as the marriage is giving you what you want and it's a good marriage. But if the marriage goes downhill again, then it won't be long to the allure of going back to the other relationship outweighs the benefits of continuing to stay clear of that other relationship. So I just think, when someone's trying to break off a relationship, it is a unilateral decision. They need to be willing to do, I think, whatever it takes to keep that thing off. I'm a little concerned. I understand his point of not wanting to move out. I typically don't recommend separations except in rather extreme cases for specific reasons. I don't know that this would be one of them. I don't know enough information here. If I were you, I would want to see a lot on his part in terms of what's he willing to do or what is his plan. I mean, how is he gonna keep it safe? And how do the two of you talk about it? How do you stay in constant, communication about it? Because not talking about it isn't the solution to this sort of thing. It's the ability to ultimately talk about it. I want to put us in a position for the best possible success. I just don't know, because I don't know what you're trying to do. Is it possible to be apart and still work on our marriage together? Absolutely. And my concern from what you've written in the letter, sometimes if we look at a separation as a punishment or a discipline, I don't think that's, in other words, to control the other person, I don't see that as really all that helpful. If we look at it as I need that in order for me to feel safe, and it's my boundary to protect myself, and I don't know whether or not you're safe, at that point, maybe I would see the separation. Sometimes, especially if there are desire disorders and someone's not broken off a relationship, I really do, if a relationship is not broken off, always recommend separation. and because I don't think there's just not anything good that's going to come from that. I think they need to make up their mind. And if he feels like he's made up his mind, I recommend getting kind of a third party to look at what plans you're thinking about doing, like to kind of maybe assess what it's going to do for relapse prevention and really have a really good relapse prevention plan in place, and then do the things you want to do. Get with other couples, by the way, in community, where you can continue talking with others. I think where, and maybe for me, when I relapsed 5 years into my recovery, from that day on, the one thing I did that was really different is I had met with other men, and I try to be completely open. I don't assume I can do it. The best relapse prevention tool is someone assuming they absolutely can't. So when I hear somebody saying and believing that really they could do it, you know, there but for the grace of God, and they just know the biggest thing is for them not to put themselves in situations, and they're really trying to be weak and not strong. When I see people doing that, then I know that the probabilities of they're not relapsing go up dramatically. Because they're always trying to avoid circumstances rather than thinking they can handle circumstances. And so that whole sense of brokenness, I think, is going to be a big part of whether or not you can determine if he's going to be safe or not. Let's go to the next one. What do you do when spouses' attempts at gift-giving, saying at Valentine's Day, trigger awful memories in the hurt spouse? I want to be able to accept the gift and feel the love with which it was given, but I'm blinded by the history associated with the gift and then thrown off balance by their unawareness. Also by the awareness that I need to feel desire, chosen, wanted, and he either doesn't feel that way about me or is incapable of showing it to me. And I know that he's capable of showing it to others. The Valentine's Day was matched in pain only by wondering, would you spend 4 hours talking about an emotional care partner? How do I cope? I think ultimately you begin by looking at the other person's heart. I think it's kind of what we were talking about earlier. Frequently attempts at trying to be intimate, when those end up being reminders of what happened in another relationship, you know, it creates a great deal of difficulty. And it doesn't, well, you start by looking at a heart and knowing that maybe people don't always get it right. I think that, you know, for, and then maybe you even question at times, the assumption at the end, when you know that maybe they've done it with someone else or whatever, I just believe a lot of times there's a counterfeit and there's the real. And frequently when people think that they're doing something like they're being, I look back at what I thought was real in my life and things I expressed maybe to lovers versus to my wife, and I thought that maybe that was the real. If you'd looked at the two, it looked like what I was doing with the other person might have been more significant than what I was doing with Stephanie. And all I would say in response to that is I had no idea. All I was doing even then was it was still 100% totally self-centered and about me, and all I was doing was trying to make the other person think about me. And all of my efforts to do what I did was in an attempt to make them think I was wonderful, and it was still self-centered. The first person I ever tried to love was Stephanie, and it was after I had blown up the world. And I think in your situation that, again, what you think his ability to do it for another, I don't think he ever did it for another. I think that typically what people are trying to do is learn it for the first time when they go through this. Don't give up, and there is hope. What do you say to the hurt spouse, and what do you say to the betrayer? That don't give up, and there is hope, when these are in short supply. To the hurt spouse, you know, Einstein says that you can never solve a problem by the same consciousness by which it was created. And, you know, considering that maybe the way we look at reality may or may not be right, that there may be things we don't understand, that we can continue to look. To the Hertzfeld, there is hope. The very fact, I mean, I've seen cases where somebody's not trying, and those are pretty hopeless. Somebody not getting it right, but trying, to me, there's always hope. Again, I try to judge people far more by heart than by their ability to pull something off. And so, you know, it's funny in recovery, I always laugh because I used to always judge myself, as it says in the book, you know, by my intentions, while everybody else judged me by my actions. And yet, I think oftentimes in recovery, judging the other person or looking to the other person's intention and heart and not judging them by their actions is actually an important way to begin to look at it. And I would actually say that to both parties, there is hope. And the bottom line is, it's all about heart and a willingness to continue. As they say in program, don't give up. You know, you just, it works if you work it. It's just a painful process as you go through it. So here's help, I'm drowning. It's been a while, hope you remember us. My husband has never gotten help or sought out therapy. And I'm so done with this marriage. I want to stay together for the kids, but that's about it. I'm beginning to talk to old boyfriends and thinking about having an affair myself. Maybe it would help me feel better. I need to talk. Can you help? I've become a little obsessed with seeking out love and attention elsewhere and don't want to do anything I would regret. I've thought about group therapy, but not sure if that would help. I'm just a big sobbing mess and would love your opinion on where to turn. All this time I've hated my husband for his betrayal, and now I feel that I'm about to betray him. I just want to be happy like I was before I found out about what he had done. My first thought is you're far better off if you feel like your husband's not going for it, in my mind. Ending the relationship and trying to find something meaningful. My concern for you, if you go out and you try to find it elsewhere but still try to maintain the relationship, is you damage you. And it always, you know, breaks my heart when I'm dealing with somebody who kind of in that attempt just to breathe ends up compromising themselves and compromises their own values, and ultimately it doesn't make you feel better. Ultimately, it has a tendency to create self-loathing and self-contempt, and I think you're better off if you can sit there and say to your husband, there's nothing, this is a dead relationship, and before I do something I regret, and I would rather, you know, get out of this thing. I think that again, compromising yourself, I just don't think you want to go there. It's never been a good path, I think, either for either party. And certainly it seems like a legitimate path at times if your mate has betrayed you. And so it would make us want maybe to think that that's going to be a solution, since it's something that our mate has done. I wish that if your mate was so blooming unhappy and felt like the way to survive in the relationship was to supplement it with something else, I think that you would have preferred for sure if they had said, I'm out of here. I think that's the kind of that has a lot more self-respect for you. And would serve you better. Now, one of the other questions, I think that being isolated right now is not what you need. So either group therapy or being with other maybe women who are going through this could be really helpful. Harboring Hope, I think, can be really useful. The online group is nice if you're kind of isolated so that you could actually talk with other people online and kind of maintain a support system. I think that trying to be honest with your husband about where you're at and kind of your need to move forward and move on and ask him how do we unwind this thing, maybe getting professional help. At the very least, where do you turn? You might want, my first thought for you is Harboring Hope to see if maybe that would help. I mean, you can't make your husband do anything. And if you get a mentor couple or something like that, it certainly gives you the ability to have a place that you can talk. So maybe that's something that would also be useful for you. If you know other women who have gone through this that you can actually begin to verbalize and talk with, I think that would also be a helpful path for you. Asking your husband maybe to once again to look at his issue. If he's continuing in his behaviors, like I said in one of the earlier calls, if he's still kind of down that path, then you may want to consider a separation type route, unless you're just already done with the relationship. It sounds like you're just really hurting at this point. And, one of the things that in the first thing I'm looking here, my husband has never gotten help or sought therapy, and I'm so done. I guess one of the things I would wonder is he continuing to act out? And, is he changing? If not, I certainly understand the despair and the kind of the lack of protection that he's bringing to you. So also would suggest maybe confronting him. Again, maybe a third-party therapist would be someone that could talk and help. That would be very useful. I'm sorry you're going through all of that. Let's see here. Let's see. So we've got a couple of questions. What was the other book? Not Sheet Music, not Pinner, but the last one. Oh, The Gift of Sex. And I believe The Gift of Sex is also a book that is by Pinner and Pinner, if I'm not mistaken. And let's see, Rick, you talked about the benefits of meditation recently. Can you explain exactly what you're meaning by meditation, what it is, and how it's done? Okay, that is a huge question. But when I talk about meditation, I'm really talking probably more about contemplative prayer for me, and it's a matter of, I always feel that the biggest struggle I have in life is how do I get out of this little deceived false self that's always self-centered and egocentric and all about me and get back into what I would call the center with God, where maybe God's on the, where God's on the throne and not me. And being able to, it's kind of by learning to get through the crazy thoughts in my mind, and those are the meditations that I typically talk about. It's like, how do I begin to be aware of that false self or that small, egocentric, self-serving self and begin to sort of analyze that? Oftentimes I think prayer is a form of meditation. I mean, to me, it's I just want to be consciously aware of God and participating and listening and doing listening prayer. There's an interesting CD about listening prayer that I really like. It's called Receiving from God by Lisa Peck. And that's of the, I guess, the people. You can buy it at closertohisvoice.com. And she actually does some guided prayer about just kind of listening to God. One of the exercises I do with people is I'll have them do what I call maybe just a centering prayer, and I'll, every time they breathe in, it's almost like a breathing prayer. They'll go, Abba, I belong to you. Abba, I belong to you. And Abba in Aramaic is daddy. And it's just beginning to kind of just focus on for maybe 20 minutes, just Abba, I belong to you. Oftentimes for the unfaithful spouse, when they're really being tempted, one of the things I might have them contemplate or meditate on is maybe Jesus hanging on a cross. Because I want to understand sin's loathsomeness in God's sight. I mean, what it really cost. And I don't want to think it's a small thing. And so I'll use meditation or contemplative prayer in that sense. Sometimes Thomas Keating has an interesting exercise where in our conscious thoughts, interestingly enough, we're able to process up to about 35 bits of information a second, which isn't bad, but our subconscious, maybe the deeper waters of our soul, is able to process up to 1.3 million bits of information a second. And we kind of think the part of us that's thinking, that part Descartes says, you know, I think, therefore I am, that that's who we are. And I would say absolutely not. I mean, because we think we're not. I mean, it's because the problem with the false self is it's very negative. It's very critical. It's always requirement-based. It's always judgmental. It has nothing to do, I think, or very little to do with love and grace. And so in this exercise that Keating suggests, you imagine yourself sitting on the bank of the river of life, and you just sit down for 20 to 30 minutes, set a timer, and every time a negative thought comes that you know isn't from God, because I feel like as God's sheep, sheep only have two relevant voices in their life, the voice of the shepherd and the voice of the butcher. The voice of the butcher is negative, critical, fearful, condemning. The voice of the shepherd's life-giving, encouraging, expansive, edifying, a lot of things. It's just caring, you know? And so I try to listen to those negative voices as I just sit very still before God. And every time a negative thought comes, one that I know is from the butcher and not from the shepherd, I just stick it on a boat. I go, oh, there's fear. And I stick it on the boat, and I'm just being still enough. Watch fear float off down the river of life, and I go, okay, well, there's shame. I'm feeling, okay, well, I put shame on it, and watch it float off down the river of life, and maybe in a while I go, man, I'm doing really good at that. And okay, well, there's pride, and I put pride on the boat, because I want to move beyond the emotions into that deeper water and just learn to be very still, and I think practice just being present in the presence of God. If you contemplative prayer, some good books by Thomas Merton. I like some of his writings. I think that there's some stuff by Richard Rohr on contemplative prayer. Trying to think of on the Protestant side, that's on the Catholic side. There is, and I'm blank. I'll try to come back with that one. But I hope that gives a little bit. It's really about trying to get me out of the way and just be very still. One last thing that I pray as we end the call here today. Oftentimes, and I try to do this prayer every day, and it's part of my contemplative prayer, that meditation. But I'll say, okay, God, in this moment, I'm not going to think about the future, because it's my fear of the future that robs me of my joy of being able to experience you in the moment. And in this moment, I'm not going to think about the past, because it's my false pride, the chaos, my, you know, resentments that rob me of my joy of experiencing you in this moment. And in this moment, I'm not going to worry about my to-do list, because it's the chaos up in my brain that robs me of my joy of experiencing you in this moment. And finally, Lord, you know, I accept that you've got me right where you want me, that this is the perfect set of circumstances for me to move into deeper realities with you. And I don't need things to be perfect. I just want what I need ultimately to come to you and to come to a deeper understanding of life. So it's okay with me. And then what I do is I sit there and see how long can I go without a thought of the past or, you know, the future or my to-do list or me screaming at God that this is just not acceptable to me type of situation. I just try to flow through time moment by moment by moment, trying just to be present and to sense his presence within me. And just to be still and to be near and to listen. One other type of listening that I do that, again, goes back to meditation and maybe contemplative prayer, listening prayer, I'll take the book of John. And every question that Jesus asks in the book of John, I recommend that, you know, you answer that question. And then be still and silent and pray and maybe see if you can sense what God's telling you in response to the answer you gave to the question he asked. I don't know. There's different ways of doing that. I hope that gives you a few little suggestions. So that's about all for today, guys. Thank you very much for joining the call, and I look forward to talking with you next Monday.